It's SMASH is a public health network, so I'll just go over its aims to remind you who may be less familiar with its work. It aims to highlight the role of the NHS in playing the role that NHS has to play in sustainable energy and resource use, reductions in environmental vulnerability, and realising the potential for health co-benefits. It aims to encourage and coordinate good innovative practice, sharing information between individuals and organisations across Scotland, and provide public health leadership focus on sustainability. Our current work programme has a stream looking at capability and capacity in the workforce within Scotland. So the aims of these CPD sessions are just to raise awareness of some of the issues related to environmental sustainability and climate change, and to increase the capability and understanding and capacity within the workforce more generally. So thank you to Jackie Hyland to volunteer for this session to try it out. I will hand over to Jackie. Jackie is a consultant in public health medicine based in NHS Tayside. She was the first chair of SMASH, and she's currently a board member of Scottish Natural Heritage. So welcome to those that have just joined. We're just going to hand over to Jackie now to do the presentation, and we will have time for questions at the end. The numbers aren't huge that are joining, so we could probably do it if you just shouted out your name. It wouldn't be too chaotic, but can I ask that you either use my email address or mobile number just to send over questions, which I'll then feed into Jackie for response, just so that we can try out the process to see how effective that will be. So without any further ado, I'll hand over to Jackie.
Thanks, Anne. It's great to be able to do this. This is, as Anne said, a pilot. So if you work with us, we may get some quirky moments when we don't know how we're going to deal with some of the answers and the questions. But what I'll do is I'll go through probably about 6 or 7 minutes, and then stop and see if people want to ask some questions. So if you want to start sending in your questions as soon as any issues arise, we'll pause at each point. Otherwise, you might get a bit sort of lost and frustrated by not getting some of your questions answered as we move on. So just what I'm going to present on is this is the basis of a medical doctorate that I just finished. And I got into this because we had an air pollution area in Cooper in Fife, where I live. And I was called in by the Environmental Health Department in Fife to have a chat from my public health hat on about the impact on health. And because it was close to home and I understood the community and everything, it was quite a surprise to me that we had an air pollution problem, and quite a surprise at how complex the whole issue is. So in the best interest of learning what I could, I went off and tried to find out what the health impact was, and then realised it's a lot more complex than that. So this presentation is a brief summary of my MD thesis, so there's a lot in it, but we'll pick up just a couple of key points as we go through it, and I'm happy to have some chat about that. So really the area that I'm covering is both the physical and the social impact. That means not just sort of the health bit of it, but also the socioeconomic impact. So if we spend money on this, are we taking money away from elsewhere? And is it good value for money? So that's a wee part of the thesis that I wrote up. So moving on to slide 2, just as a background, this is the basis that I always think on, and it's a basis that comes from clear environmental policy. That there's 3 steps we've either got. We firstly have to have a source, then a pathway, then a receptor. And the way that we intervene in terms of preventing hazards causing harm is to put a blockage either between the source by reducing that, the pathway by taking the people away from the source in some way, or the person themselves, you know, who are more vulnerable and who do we need to be aware of in terms of their health or ill health. So that's the kind of principles that I'm working on. So I'm on to slide 3, and that's part of the background, just to let you know where we are with air quality. And this graph shows how air quality over the baseline year of 1990, that's on the x-axis, has been improving over the years for many things. You can see a dramatic drop in lead at the bottom there, that's from the petrol changes. SO2, that's from the power stations and the use of coal was a big one. And we can see the one at the top there is the NH3, and a lot of that's now coming from agriculture, so we need to keep an eye on that. And down in the middle there, we'll see PM10s and NOxes. They've been dropping gradually over the years, and we've got a wee bit more to do because we'd like to get them right down as far as possible. So I'm just going to move on to the next slide. The next slide is the first part of the thesis I did was, you know, what's the evidence behind the health problems? And what I did was look at all the research from the years 1990 to 2013 when I did my MD. The reason I chose 1990 is because before those times, there was a lot of pollution that wasn't regulated for, and around that time, we started to get much better environmental regulation. So I wanted a good, decent, long time period. That 1990 seems a great place to start in terms of looking at the studies. The next thing was to look at the most robust studies, can't do randomised controlled trials. So cohort studies are a great way to look at populations over a long period of time and see if they've been had an exposure and what impact that's had on their health. So I looked at all the literature from 1990 to 2013 for cohort studies related to any health impact from traffic-related air pollution and kept it down to that. Now, you might be surprised I'm only sitting there with three studies, and this was because when we did the studies reported very different kind of outcomes. Some reported on stroke, some reported on respiratory disease. They also reported the stats in many different ways, and in order to see how common they were, you know, how foolproof they were rather than individual studies, we brought them together into a forest plot. So I found three studies which related mortality, all-cause mortality, and NOxes. And you can see from that that there is, in two of the studies, a difference, a significant difference in exposure to NOxes and increase in all-cause mortality. That's the Cessonari, a very small significant difference, and the Heinrich study. But the Eurofew study didn't really show a significant difference. So this wasn't terribly inspiring, given the number of studies that came out, that we could actually only find a couple that actually looked very similar. So the next slide, this is the forest plot for the hazard ratio for respiratory lung disease, which is a bit clearer. Again, I only managed to get three which reported in the same way. The Anderson study showed a small significant difference in exposure and impact. The Heinrich study, much clearer difference. And the Eurofew study also showed a difference, a significant difference. So if you were exposed to NOxes, you had a higher risk of respiratory or lung disease compared to people who weren't exposed. But despite that, I couldn't find anything in any of the other things which people are claiming to affect their health. So I move on to the next slide, which shows the number of papers reporting each health-related outcome. The most common thing people reported on was birth outcomes, which is not unexpected, because you can actually take a woman at point of pregnancy to point of delivery and monitor things like gestational size, circumference of head, etc. So you have a start and an end point. And then you measure that against exposure. But despite all these studies, you couldn't actually find a strong connection between exposure to air pollution and health. So out of the, I managed to find 30 cohort studies, and there was 9 reviews. And out of those, only 10 related to pregnancy, 9 reported on all-cause mortality, 4 on respiratory infections, 4 on asthma, 2 on allergies, 2 on preeclampsia, etc., down the list. So you can see after all these studies, nobody's actually looking at exactly the same thing in terms of exposure, so it's difficult to actually build a picture which is consistent. So I was going to stop there and see if anybody had any questions on the basis of that initial introduction.
Okay, I haven't received any questions, so I'm assuming that everybody's okay with that so far. Shout now.
Anne, sorry, John Redshaw. Just a question for Jackie, and I know you asked me that I email it in, but in the interest of time, I'll be quick. I wondered to what extent you'd looked at the work that COMIAP are doing at the moment and have been doing for some time, Jackie, in relation to coming up with advice on NOx and NO2. We've been waiting for their report for a while now, as you probably know. And I wondered what evidence that they had been looking at and whether you had considered that.
Yeah, well, I didn't because they were doing it at the time I was doing my MD, so they hadn't produced the results, so it wasn't included in this at that point in time. But I did look at, there was a series of cohort studies in Europe. I'll just go back into my... Saltar study. Let me just go into my MD. And I was waiting for them. By the time they had started in 2000, the time I wrote it up in 2017, they had also looked at a lot of cohort studies, and they were also finding a little bit of a woolly picture in relation to this. Now, just to be clear, it's not to say that air pollution doesn't cause harm. What we are saying is that actually proving it scientifically is very difficult to do. And so COMIAP haven't produced anything on that, probably because of the same reason. It's very, very difficult to prove a cause and effect. And one big chapter of my MD was then taking it forward and saying, you know, how strong is this association between exposure to air pollution and the health effects? And the next bit I'll go on to will explain what the weaknesses were in terms of the studies, which may be why COMIAP are struggling to produce something definitive that people would sort of be able to accept. Does that help?
Yes, it does. I was aware of the work by people like Ian Mudway at King's College London, who've looked at lung development and function, particularly in children in Tower Hamlets and Hackney, in relation to traffic-related pollution from NOx. So that's one area of work that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
I just simply flagged that for the moment.
Yeah, just to answer that very quickly, the issue with that is if you're looking at children and their air exposure, they're exposed to an awful lot more than outdoor air pollution, and that's the problem. It's the other factors they're exposed to. And so I'll tip onto that in the next couple of slides to explain a bit more.
Thank you.
Okay, shall we carry on then, Jackie?
Carry on, yes, sorry, yes. So I'm now on this, the socioeconomic impact of, just to show that there's an awful lot of issues that surround individuals' health. So, for example, in the old days, there was people who smoked and had no problems, a few of them, and people who smoked became very ill, and some people who smoked got cancer, but not everybody got the same thing, and that's because we're all different. So this, the Whitehead et al. Sort of diagram explains a lot of that. It's not just ourselves and who we are, but our lifestyle factors, our community that we live in, the work and conditions that we experience, and other environmental factors. So I put that there because that underpins an awful lot of the issues that we need to see. That's why air pollution per se is very complex. So I'm on to the next slide, which is confounding factors, which were considered in the cohort studies. So you would have expected when these scientists did this, that they would eliminate everything like if anybody had cardiovascular disease or preceding asthma, then you take that into account when you're looking at the number of people who are living in an air pollution area and their symptoms that follow. But what was worrying is an awful lot of them didn't take all these things into account. In fact, very few of them took all the key things into account. So, for example, obesity has an impact on your cardiovascular system, and a lot of them accounted for that, which was fine, but not all of them. Remember, I had 39 studies and only 40 of them, 14 accounted for that. Hypertension surprised me. Only 13 accounted for hypertension, and yet that is a cardiovascular outcome and a stroke outcome. Asthma, only 12 accounted for asthma. So, you know, an awful lot of underlying problems could be related to asthma symptoms associated with pollen, etc. The outpatient appointments which were used as a measure weren't necessarily associated with traffic, but may have been associated with pollution or pollen associated with where they lived. Cardiovascular disease, pre-existing diabetes, respiratory disease. So going down that list, you see very few of the studies, 39 studies, actually included everything. The closest study that ever came to them is the one that's quoted in the PHE document, which is Pope et al. And that was a study that was done before 1990. And it was a very good study in terms of taking everything into account. Not all things, but almost everything. But again, it reflected people who were exposed in the 70s and 80s, where air pollution was considerably different to the air pollution we have today. And they were exposed to, for example, sulfur dioxide, etc. And you don't know which element of the air pollution has caused the harm. So that's one of the issues that began to worry me a little bit about the studies in terms of why we weren't finding the same thing, and it was because not everybody was even taking account of the same coexisting features. So what we thought was, well, bear that in mind, and the confounding factors are, I should have mentioned, John, to follow up with, indoor air pollution was a big issue, and one of the things that came up in the pregnancy studies was that very few people actually looked at how much time people spent indoors. And when you're pregnant, when you're a young child, and when you're an elderly person, you tend to spend more time indoors. So that was one of the issues that weren't really taken into account, whereas the working-age adult tends to spend more time travelling to and from work and exposed to traffic in industrialised areas. So that didn't come out very well in the studies, and that may be why we're having difficulty in putting a direct link between one thing and another. But anyway, despite all of that, we decided to see if we could apply the national data to the populations in Scotland. So we did, firstly, an air quality needs assessment study and looked at all the people that live in air quality management areas in Scotland. There's 29,000 of them live in what are called air quality management areas. And we looked at them. That's 1% of our population live in these areas. Most are aged between 29 and 40 years of age. They're not elderly and vulnerable, and they're not young children. More men than women, marginally. 19%, only 19% were in the most deprived quintile. And we believe that's because air quality management areas are city centre. City centre properties are expensive, so either you're multiple occupancy as a student, so you're relatively young, or you're a professional who could afford it. The mortality and hospitalisation rates were lower than in non-air quality management areas, which would make sense because you have to be pretty ill to end up in hospital. And these are younger people who may be able to manage episodes of asthma without hospital admissions, unlike elderly people. But anyway, my colleague David McAllister, who did the study, said that if we actually reduced the air pollution, and the figure was 13, he took the highest air pollution area in Glasgow to bring it down to regulatory levels, and an average level would be 13 micrograms per metre cubed of particulates, then you would save 73 attributable deaths per annum, approximately. But if we did it for the whole country and reduced it only by 1 microgram per metre cubed, we would save even more deaths. And that makes sense because, quite frankly, if we actually do it across the country rather than just these air quality, we have a much bigger impact on transport issues, etc., than if we focused only on one small area, with people who are not necessarily in that area all the time and with younger people who are not necessarily suffering from the exposure of the air pollution in the way that vulnerable people would. The same thing came through to hospitalisations for the air quality areas. It was only just under 2,000, and for non-air quality areas, there was much bigger hospitalisation rates. So we took it to the next day and said, OK, so these are young people, they don't see them going into hospital. What we might see is them reporting to NHS 24 if they have respiratory problems, runny eyes, stingy noses. It's a bit like what's happening in Manchester at the moment with the big fire. People are complaining of stinging eyes, etc. So in 2012, there was a short 5-day period of high pollution. So we took that in the central belt and looked at, and I'm on to slide, record of air pollution levels, and it's got two graphs with two red lines. One says Edinburgh St Leonard's and one says Glasgow Centre. Okay, and I'm going to go on to the next slide. And we've got the data from NHS 24 for the symptoms that we would expect for air pollution. So in this graph on the left-hand side, it says date range. So the 13th of March is the week before the problem. The 20th of March was the week of the problem. The 20th and 9th of March was the week after the problem. So we wanted to see if there was a difference. NHS 24 got 95,000 total records that we looked at in this area, 29,000. And then the number of, for NHS 24 calls, the number of records by Edinburgh came through at 284 in that period, and by Glasgow, 30,000 calls in that period. Quite a big difference. Ignore that number. I'll need to check on it. But anyway, the calls before the air pollution area in Edinburgh were 43, during it were 40, and after were 39. In Glasgow, the calls before were 111, during the week was 147, and after was 114. We break that down, because that was every call, break it down to the symptoms related to air pollution. We had 10, 8, and 4 for Edinburgh, so during the week was actually fewer calls, and the week after was less again. Glasgow had 22, then 37, so it went up and then back down again. Now, the 37, actually, some of that we have had slightly more calls for cardiovascular disease during that week, just a marginal increase in cardiovascular disease. But they didn't have any increase in calls for the ones we would expect in terms of asthma. They actually went down that week. They didn't have any increase in calls for runny eyes, etc. So this wasn't a terribly robust way of doing it, because it suggests something that can't be proved, because Edinburgh had the same pollution problem and the same deprivation kind of area as well, and we didn't have an increase in calls. So we couldn't really use NHS 24 to measure anything. The other thing to note about Glasgow Central, that's the St Enoch Centre, that's down at the bottom end of Glasgow. So we don't know how many people actually passed through that area and went home and had symptoms, or many people actually lived in that area and were actually out that day and came back to that area and weren't actually exposed to it. So it's a very complex system. So it's just a way, could we use NHS 24? And we weren't 100% sure we could. We didn't go ahead and do a full-scale one because they had done something similar at Bonfire Night in Scotland and found the air pollution in that period didn't make any difference. to the calls to NHS24. So it seemed fairly consistent that it's not robust enough to record individual experiences. So finally, to see if we could actually record it, if local authorities put in low emission zones, I go into the Dundee ward area study. And in that, we looked at a road which is an air pollution road, which is Lockie Road. And if you look at the map, you can see a small number one, and you can see a small number two. And there's a road in the middle which is on that red line, that's Lockie Road. That has an air quality problem. So we looked at the health of the population on one side and the other side to see if there was air pollution related problems. But as you can see, the geographical distribution is quite wide. So people living on the road within 300 metres really can't be picked up by our data. The second problem we had was that one side of the road, number one, is at area deprivation, and the other side of the road, number two, is an area of high affluence. So if I could take you on to the next slide. So we looked at coronary heart disease admissions, and you can see that they're much higher on Coalside and much lower on West End. Both populations lived on the road, but you couldn't tell whether it was the pollution that was causing the problem or the deprivation. The likelihood, given the size of the population, it was more likely deprivation than the pollution, because there's very few people lived on either side of the road. So again, we couldn't use normal data to help local authorities say, if you do something about that road, you will improve health, because there's so many other influences on health out with that. So I'm going to stop there to take any questions before going to the next one.
Hi Jackie, it's Anne. I haven't received any questions by text or by email, but does anybody have anything that they want to raise at this precise moment? I'll take that as a no. So if you want, just carry on, Jackie.
Okay, great. So the next thing was to actually say, okay, let's just accept that information is ropey in terms of the science. That's a wee bit tricky for us, but let's accept that we do know air pollution will cause health. For example, the Manchester is a classic example. You can't be exposed to it without suffering symptoms. But the level of air pollution that we have might be very small, so it's very, very difficult to prove. But people have been working on it for years and done a great job, and therefore we wanted to see from their experience what had been making a difference. So I went and asked all the policymakers and professionals who've been working on this for years what they thought would make a difference. And this was the study, which is the perceived barriers to change. And the biggest perception that people had was that we're not really integrating our planning, our infrastructure services. So we're building in areas which are already populated areas. Let me give you an example in Glasgow, where they've redeveloped the Strathclyde area, which is really nice university buildings, but they've just created another canyon there. So unless we do something about that, we're going to get more air pollution there. So if we don't think these things through, we're going to have problems. But the other thing is we live in many historic cities, like Perth, for example, Aberdeen, where the layout of the cities are such, and Glasgow, are such that it's difficult to get away from the canyon effect. So that's a big issue we should be starting to take into account, but it's a long-term issue. The second one was, we really need to have private transport or vehicular transport to get around, not only because we've got a variable climate in our country, but because we have long distances, and I'll come back to that, long distances to travel. So if we can do something about that and make public transport cleaner and more accessible, we might be able to achieve something. And the third one was really, at that time, a lack of understanding, and I think that one's well gone past, because I think everybody's very well aware now of the air pollution issues that we need to address. So moving on to the next slide, I looked at the incentives for change, and very quickly, really the big one that came up was, let's get our subsidise and improve our public transport, get people moving, because there's a double benefit here. If we get the cleaner air, we'll also get people taking more exercise, and get the public involved in this. And I think a lot of this is now beginning to come to play. And then the longer term planning and infrastructure. And health was there, not at the top list, because people didn't see it as the key thing, because many people, as you remember, are healthy and treating to move around more than they're worried about the air pollution. But that's a big issue for us. So I'm moving on to the next one. So how do we encourage people to change? Well, we start to promote the healthier lifestyle, so they don't just think about air quality, but they think of the benefits of taking the walking to school and all the rest of it. We promote the idea that it's a much better environment, more pleasant for people to work and walk in. And the big one, also saving money. We have to look at the bits that hit most and saving money. It's got to save money rather than cost more money. So I'm on to the main mode of travel, just to point out that the fact that we do have a problem in Scotland in terms of walking and cycling. We have a different population. areas. For example, there's a lot of cycling and walking in the Netherlands, but they have almost 70% of their population live in urban areas and walk and cycle, and we have fewer people living in our urban areas. So we're going to have a problem there anyway in terms of transport. We have a lot of commuting that needs to be done. So this shows you that it's not always easy for us to do that in remote rural areas. And rural isn't that far. I live in Fife. It's pretty rural just outside the door, you know. So the next slide is a type of real-world vehicle emissions. And I put this up because it's been known for a long time that our vehicles, although we might buy clean ones, aren't necessarily as clean as we thought. So just to park that one, that's finally come through to the fore, and that we really are pushing hard, and the engine manufacturers are really pushing hard at cleaning up the vehicles, and I think that's really good in terms of the publicity side, and we're moving in the right direction. So any questions on that before I move to the next one?
I haven't received anything, Jackie, so is there any questions?
Sorry, I was in the midst of typing. It's Rebecca Campbell here. It's kind of going back to slightly before that, in terms of the health effects. In that there, it can't be evidenced the long-term, or it's kind of a bit shady in terms of the long-term evidence, in that we can demonstrate the short-term impact, so in terms of, you know, carbon monoxide in the blood and what have you, and the blood becoming stickier and thicker. Are a lot of the health claims that are being made about air pollution and the impact of that based on those short-term impacts? Because we can kind of extrapolate or I guess second guess what will happen if you're continually exposed to that kind of pollution?
Yes and no. The most of the studies have been done on massive big populations rather than small numbers. But there have been individual studies done, some of them in Edinburgh, in terms of the uptake of pollutants. But the response to them is very different, and that's one of the key things. So when you say you can demonstrate the short-term impacts, we can't really do that in the small populations and the small levels of pollutants that we've got. So that's why I kind of brought back to the Manchester one. You need to have either incredibly high level of pollution, which you'll see in India and China, etc., and used to see over in America, sort of in San Francisco area. So they can have a population they can study because the pollution's very high. They don't need as big a population, or in the European ones, which are sort of the large population, more cross-sectional studies that they have to do. So it is very difficult to do that, and the bit that's difficult to tease out is how much of that is to do with indoor air pollution, mm-hmm. and how much is to do with outdoor air pollution. So in India, for example, where they have more biomass fuels, etc., and indoor cooking, how much is related to the traffic and the industry, and how much is actually related to indoor inhalation? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I suppose I watched too much TV, and there was a kind of programme on air pollution, and they were kind of showing if somebody was cycling around or in the car, that kind of short-term, but I know that's obviously just one person.
That's a good one, because that actually just came out recently in the Lancet article, which turned around and said that the person cycling is actually inhaling more of the pollutant down into their lungs than the person sitting in the car. But actually the study that they showed that the person who was cycling at the end of the day lived longer because the fact that they were cycling, not always in a polluted area, gave them greater benefits to health.
Yeah.
So, for example, in our areas in Scotland, we wouldn't spend a long time cycling up Hope Street in Glasgow,
yeah.
which is a polluted street, compared to the other roads which are less polluted. But in London, you might spend a lot of time cycling through a polluted area.
Yeah.
But the cycling itself is a huge benefit to health.
Jackie, John Redshaw here, and maybe best left till the end for a fuller discussion. But I'll fire in a few points. Certainly, in terms of that last point, there was a paper that was published looking at the, if you like, the benefits, disbenefits of cycling in different levels of air pollution, and obviously the higher the level of air pollution. The less time you should cycle for before the cycling starts to cause a detrimental effect. But looking at the approach here, there are many ways of looking at the health impacts of air pollution, and epidemiology is one of those. There's obviously direct exposure where people cycle in chambers and they breathe in air pollution, and the movement of air pollution through the body can be tracked, and biomarkers can be used to assess the levels of exposure and impacts. And the work I mentioned earlier, just to mention that, with the children in Hackney and Tower Hamlets, does actually go, they go into schools and they do take urine and cheek swabs, and they can look, they do look at biomarkers of exposure, and they can link exposure to reduction in lung development and lung function. So I just sort of put those in there. I know a lot of work has been done on PM10 over the years and PM2.5, and that tends to be long-term exposure, doesn't it, where we would see the health impacts from that. And I think one of the big challenges here, just very briefly, is that assessing exposure and health impact, isn't it? Because, as you say in your study, you don't know whether, to what extent people are moving around in that zone or just living there and then travelling and spending most of their time elsewhere.
Yeah, and that's a very good point, because that's exactly where we need to go next, is actually looking at individual vulnerabilities. So, for example, the children in the school who are getting the swabs and the testing done, some of them will have adverse effects and others won't, because of genetic makeup, because of coexisting exposures elsewhere, because of infections, etc. And that's exactly where we need to go in the future, to identify who are more vulnerable to the lower levels of pollution at levels below even the guideline levels.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Do you want to carry on, Jackie?
Yep. Thank you. So I just did an economic analysis, because I was getting a wee bit concerned that, as a public health person, I was going to be asked to prove that if they introduced a low emission zone that it improved health. And as I already said, it was going to be very difficult in the areas that we've got to show that a huge investment in money would make a difference to health. And obviously money is a big thing. We need to make sure we spend it wisely. For me, it would be great if by tackling air quality we improved health, because we improved exercise, we made people healthier that way. So there's a plus to all of this. It's not about being negative of air pollution. It's about, let's see, the co-benefits of improving health. So what I did is I took some of the national data and actually broke it down to see what the costs were in relation to this. So I'm on to the estimated premature deaths from urban air pollution, Europe and Scotland. So the European data is quite robust, and they've got, and I broke it down and did it proportionally to see what it would cost. And if I take the total population of Europe being 500 million, and our population is 5 million, then the percentage of the urban population in Europe is less than ours. We've got 81% in an urban population in Scotland. So you do that pro rata. And of our urban population, only 24,000 is actually in their quality management zone, whereas in Europe we've got the 4 million bit. If you take the European data, which says out of their data, so I'm using their data to say how many premature deaths are they getting. They're getting, you know, 500,000. And we apply that in Scotland, we're estimating they'll get 24 premature deaths from air pollution. We adjust it because traffic isn't the only thing. So if we cut out traffic, this is about traffic. If we cut out traffic, we're not cutting out all air pollution. Air pollution comes from the dust from agriculture, it comes from, you know, the Sahara dust, it comes from sea salt. There's lots of different particulate sources. So air pollution accounts for traffic-related 60% of that. So we've got 14. And then if we add a cost to that, using some of these studies, the value of the statistic of life, we get an estimate of 32 million. Remember, I'm just trying to get some big estimate of figures here in terms of costs. Then if we look at, that's mortality. Let's look at morbidity in terms of, you know, it's not just about people dying, it's about time off work for, you know, asthma episodes, etc. So the European figures give us over 500 million, and the number of days was 1.3 per days for exposed population. So if I apply that 1.3 to Scotland, I'm getting a Scottish population of 31,000 exposed days. And at the cost of 184 per day, I'm getting about £5 million per annum. So again, I'm just teasing out some figures here. So I'm down onto the next, what's the risk of physical activity? Because people will say, if we put that in, there's also the risk of cycling and people dying. So you have to take that into account. But very briefly, the number of cyclists killed on the road is very, very, very few. Every death is a tragedy, but this is very few compared to the number of deaths from coronary heart disease. So if you're actually saying we're investing, but we might increase the cyclist deaths on the roads, if we're investing and people are taking more exercise, we might actually reduce the number of people dying from cardiovascular disease. I'm just putting that in there as a thought. It's all about the balance of risk, and we do not want people cyclists killed on the road, and we can prevent that by proper traffic management, etc. But we can get people taking more exercise. So on to the next one, which is the cost comparison for active travel. So it's not just about putting in low emission zones. Let's get people taking more activity. So I looked at all the different activity zones in terms of cost per quality, and dug some of these out from the literature. And the one that was most cost effective in terms of years of life lost, and those were the figures that came down to the travel smart one, which was anything from 1 to 11 million. It came down to about 1 million, so I put that in as the most effective, but it could be more expensive. So that was a study looking at travel smart and be on the internet in terms of what people did. It's just encouraging people to take more active travel. So if I put some of those costs together, with costs from London in terms of how much it costs them to introduce a low emission zone, they reckon it costs about £4.5 million. That doesn't include running costs, and it doesn't include the cost to heavy goods vehicles, which came to about 64 to 100 plus thousand for refurbishment. But anyway, if you ignore all that and just put low emission zone, and then add in the cost of a travel smart, not just close the roads but get people moving, we'd probably cost between £6 and £11 million. But that for each list, we're going to have four. We're going to have one in Dundee, Glasgow, Edinburgh and Aberdeen if required. That would bring it up to £27 to £44 million. And in terms of the number of lives saved from air pollution and from lost days at work, we could have £38 million saving. So you can see it's kind of on the borderline there. It's not a massive saving that everybody says in terms of the saved lives and costs. It's going to cost a lot of money and it will have a huge health benefit, but it's not an equal as in clear outcome from that. So I'm going to stop there and see if anybody wants to ask me any questions.
Hi, Jackie. Phil sent in a question, but I think we'll keep it to the end, if that's okay.
Right.
So do you want to just carry on? Because I know you're quite near the end of your slides. So.
Okay. So that's the premature death thing. So just to finish off, just to summarise, I thought I'd start off with a very clear MD thesis that air pollution harms health and this is how much it's harming health in Scotland. I found out the literature wasn't quite as clear as I thought it would have been. That is, there's a strong link of association but not causation because there's many other factors we have to take into account. Bearing that in mind, we wanted to see how many people would be affected if we actually improve the system and how we actually reduce it through low emission zones, what would be the impact. If we introduced a policy to do that, what would be the cost benefit? And then what would be the final impact in terms of what it means for people's lives through the studies? What do we have to do in terms of planning and development, etc.? So what we're saying at the moment is there's little impact on the population in Scotland from health that we are aware of at the population level, and that's not an individual level, because some people are more vulnerable than others, and we must bear that in mind. But we don't know, as John has said, who they are. We need to have a bit more information on that, so the studies John quoted are very relevant. We have to remember that there's wider benefits if we improve air quality in terms of exercise, and we're really plugging that side of it. We have a Clean Air for Scotland strategy. That needs a campaign behind it, and I think it's a stronger campaign now than ever was before. And it's not just about getting people to come out of the cars, it's about planning and long-term thinking as well. And we need the public behind that, so I think that's beginning to come around. And this is, I have to write this in my MD, that the socio-economic approach to bringing the two things together rather than thinking purely about, you know, air quality, health, exercise, but bringing it all together, I think it's really important to see the big picture. So, recommendations, we need to improve the emissions of vehicles, that's happening. Review urban planning pathways, investigate how people's behaviour changes, so there are different routes. Some of the hospitals in London advise people on different routes they can take for walking and exercises. Health, we need to understand vulnerability, and we need to look at the cost and the cost benefit of this, so we're not putting the money into the wrong place, and make sure we're going to get benefit out of it. And then there's acknowledgements at the end, there's tremendous help from a lot of people here on this. So that's the end of my presentation.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Jackie. So we'll take some questions now. So Phil Mackey has emailed one in, so I'll just read that out to you. Co-benefits are important. We know that healthy lifestyles, behaviour change for increasing physical activity for cardiovascular health is different from that needed for obesity reduction. Do we have similar problems here in achieving active transport for air quality improvement?
If it's any different, I think it's a different way of achieving the same aim.
Phil, do you want to follow up?
I was still online.
Yes, somewhere. You're on mute.
Bill, are you there?
When I get off mute, yes, that's fine. I suppose in a way that the example I was picking on is one where we know that the level of intensity needed for individual behaviour change to improve cardiovascular fitness is actually at a much lower level than would actually be weight managing. So if you're going to do both, you've got to go for the higher level rather than the lower one. The same, I suspect, may be true in terms of elements of improving active transport as a means of improving fitness generally through physical activity, and whether or not there are similar potential levels of which we have to push active transport, particularly through cycling, better use of walking, etc., in a way that actually genuinely reduces air quality problems. I'm guessing that actually there is a higher level of the number of people whose behaviour we have to change to affect that improvement. But it's something about that kind of core benefit. How do we actually plan to achieve the core benefit? Is there anything that you've looked at which might help us with that?
Well, this is more than coming up from the other side. A lot of people will say they can't cycle or can't walk because it's not a place they can go walking or cycling in. So this was coming to that. If you're going to actually make the air cleaner, make it possible for people to take walking and cycling, reduce the excuses that people can make. So we weren't really coming in on the, this is about improving health. This is about creating the environment that people can then move forward and improve health on.
Okay, that's a helpful kind of correction, I suppose. Therefore, in answering my own question, perhaps we have to think about how we make sure people don't overclaim on that. So that if we're trying to improve, if we're trying to remove barriers, that's one thing, but not let then people think that, oh, well, that's just going to improve everybody's health overall, isn't it? Because actually it may.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. When I looked at the exercise models, it took an awful lot of work to achieve a small gain.
Yeah, and similarly for obesity reduction, you have to more than double the amount of daily physical activity to even be weight maintaining, let alone weight reduction, compared to cardiovascular fitness. So you actually end up with lots and lots of very, very fit people if you're not careful.
Yeah, but what I was also looking at was the co-benefits of physical came into it, but what they didn't mention was also the psychological co-benefits of actually getting out and being with people.
That's
in your car. I mean, I could go on for lots of different co-benefits. What I was just trying to say is it's all worth doing. You might not see it in terms of air pollution impact on health, but the work that you're doing will improve health in many ways. And it's worth it.
Yeah, I think that for me is the major take home, I suppose, and that is if you get lots and lots of big claims about core benefit, just simply creating an environment where people have fewer excuses, which are very easily to hand, and feel good about being out there in a natural or a more natural environment is going to produce a series of perhaps unmeasurable benefits, but they are worth it of themselves. And perhaps we have to be pushing that type of line rather than trying to create evidence around real numbers saved or whatever.
Good point, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I haven't received any more questions, so does anybody want to come in on that particular issue? Or shall I take some more questions via the phone?
I've got a more general one. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes. Hi.
I'm using this phone for the first time, and I don't know which bit to speak in, but it's Chris McGuigan.
Hi, Chris.
Jackie, I just wanted to say, first of all, I've read your stuff about more general approaches to improving health and reducing air pollution, and it was very refreshing to see that, because you did it at a time when the focus was on particular zones, and that's without even talking about the potential perverse impact or unforeseen impact of reducing air pollution in the zones, but shifting it elsewhere, which is definitely one of the things that could happen with that sort of localized targets. So that was impressive. The question I've got is a slightly left field one. You mentioned other sources of air pollution apart from road traffic and agricultural stuff and wind blown sea salt and things. But another one that I've been thinking about is, and it relates to the situation near Manchester, is quite apart from wildfires, there's organised muir burn, which affects a very large proportion of Scotland's land area. About I think up to 40% is heather moorland, and an awful lot of it is managed with rotational muir burn. Has anyone looked at the air pollution impacts of that? Just wondering if you'd come across that.
John might be able to answer that, because that's not... I'm focusing on traffic-related air pollution.
Yeah, OK.
Yes, John Redshaw here from SEPA. Muir burn came up when we did some work for CAP that was chaired by James Curran, the former CEO of SEPA, and this was looking at synergies and tensions in relation to interventions to address air pollution and climate change. And we were taking a sector-based approach in line with the Scottish Government's climate change plan, and we were looking at land and agriculture within that. So there was some consideration there of muir burn. I can't remember specifically what the key point emerging from that that was, but I can certainly provide a reference to Anne to that work.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Fine, John. I can forward that on to everybody that we're aware of on the call. Is there anybody else who would like to ask something of Jackie about her presentation or about air quality more widely?
I think John Ridge, just again, thanks very much for the presentation, Jackie. And I think if I'm taking a key message away from here, using the approach that you've taken, it's difficult to demonstrate a strong cost benefit for health from lower air quality improvement in Scotland. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, but it doesn't mean it's worthwhile. It's about trying to speak the same language as the people who are actually investing the money to turn around and say it is very much worthwhile. It's very difficult to actually pin down the benefits you're going to see, but it doesn't mean it's not worth doing.
And just a few other related comments here, really, because I thought with particulate matter and with NOx, that they were essentially non-threshold pollutants. So, the lower we can take the levels, the better. And the fact that we can't pick up effects doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying to do so. And we also recognise very much the multiple benefits thing, and that the road traffic is still a very major source of greenhouse gas emissions, and something we need to address there anyway. This really ties in with creating places that work better for people, that help to drive social cohesion and enterprise and so on. And I think the sort of actions that we're taking here very much are part of a bigger blueprint for creating more successful, prosperous places for people, and to reduce inequalities as well. And on active travel, there's been an awful lot of work done by people like Bruce White at the Glasgow Centre for Population Health about active travel and the implications for socioeconomic deprivation, and you're probably well aware of that. One of the pieces of work I have been involved in is feeding into the National Transport Strategy Review, a 20-year outlook for Scotland, particularly through the Greener and Healthier Working Group. So there's innovative technology on the one hand, improving Euro 6 emissions, and there's also the behaviour change component that is very much a subject that you've raised in your presentation. So I think the work fits in very nicely into that that bigger, broader agenda, doesn't it?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you said it very eloquently. Again, it's all about making the multiple benefits you can get from placemaking, from making sure that the places we live are clean, healthy, pleasant places to be.
I was very much taken with the annual report from Sally Davies, the Chief Medical Officer in England last year, and that is really well worth looking at, and you may have done so already, but it makes some 22 recommendations for substantial change, and air pollution is very much in that space. So there's a whole host of information and strong recommendations there that are worth looking at if people haven't done so already.
Yeah, that's a very good report. The only thing I would say, I think we can take it one step further, because it comes under the title of air pollution, and I think we need to take it into how we design our places.
Yes.
Air pollution's got us onto the agenda, and now we need to look at it to see how we address it in a way which makes the whole population a lot healthier, our businesses a lot better, the way we move around much better constructed. So So, you know, there's so many multiple gains in this. But if we stick sometimes just to the title air pollution, then people will only deal with air pollution, and the knock-on impact is probably negative elsewhere. We need to bring the whole thing together.
Yep.
Okay, any final questions?
Anne, can I just raise a point, John, here again? Obviously, a number of people have joined in, and hopefully they will all email you to confirm that they have done so and to send you any points about the approach that's taken here. Is that your plan?
Yes, if people could, because it is a pilot, we'd be very grateful for the views of those that have participated on how they felt it went, any suggestions for improvement, and I would like to add also any ideas for future presentations, just so that we can start to build a programme. So yes, please do email us. The contacts for Ryan Hughes and myself can be found on the email that we sent under the slides. Okay, so as people are now disengaging, I'll bring this to a close. Thank you once again, Jackie, very much for taking the time to present to us all. And I'll get some feedback from you as well as from the perspective of the presenter. So thank you, everybody, and enjoy the rest of your Thursday.
Thanks very much, Jackie. Really helpful. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Just try to count how many... because I didn't really get a feel. Yeah.